Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Michael Patrick Cullinane about his study of the posthumous image of America's 26th president, entitled Theodore Roosevelt's Ghost, The History and Memory of an American Icon. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, thanks for agreeing to come on our podcast. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in New Jersey, and I've been working for about the last 8 years on the other side of the pond. I currently work at the University of Roehampton in London. And I think I've spent probably the last 10 years researching Theodore Roosevelt. But more broadly, I research on American diplomatic history, and I've written about a number of things in early 20th century U.S. diplomatic history. I'm a stalwart Yankees fan and very excited about the new season, which should be kicking off in the next few months with the home run stars, Stanton and Judge. And I reject any overtures to get me to watch Premier League football, despite being over here for as long as I have. I just can't get into it.
That must be quite a challenge considering how big it is over there.
Well, you know yourself, it's the same as American football, as it's called over here. You know, the spectacle of the Saturday here is the sort of any given Sunday in America.
So were you spending that decade researching Theodore Roosevelt, working on this book? How exactly did this project come to pass?
Well, I actually devised the project when I was a PhD student. I was working my PhD research was on the American anti-imperialist movement. I was fascinated by this huge movement of Americans, you know, probably more than 100,000 activists who were resisting American empire and imperialism during the early, really the first 10 years of the 20th century. And I suppose Theodore Roosevelt was in many ways the nemesis of the anti-imperialist movement, because he kind of represented this large policy in America's expanding interests in the world. But the reality was that most of these anti-imperialists really liked Theodore Roosevelt. You know, people that disagreed with him viscerally on some things could also have no problem going out to dinner with the guy, enjoying his company. And I found him a really complicated character, and that drove me to research him more. And I didn't like him at the beginning. Actually, I thought he was an imperialist and a sort of warmonger. And then you read more about the guy and suddenly these nuances come out of nowhere and you're struck by his intellect and his achievements. And so what that led me to was a question about what I could research regarding Theodore Roosevelt. What would be new? And there are currently, a rough estimate, about 350 biographies in the past 100 years, big biographies that have been written about Theodore Roosevelt. And so I thought, well, I can't write another biography. And there's hundreds of other monographs that deal with individual topics, you know, whether it's his relationship with Japan or the Russo-Japanese War or Venezuela, whatever it might be. So I thought, this has all been done. I mean, this guy's life has been covered. And so I thought the one thing that hadn't been covered, I think Edmund Morris's final volume of his trilogy of Roosevelt had come out in 2010, and there was about 9 pages dedicated to Roosevelt's death and legacy. And I thought, well, this is something that hasn't really been covered. So I got to work on figuring out how Roosevelt had been depicted, used, and abused over the last 100 years.
I find your description fascinating because it really is something that there are aspects of what you're describing that really show up very clearly in the book, because as you explain, there is this Theodore Roosevelt, of course, is a very complicated figure. And so much of that complexity plays out in how he is remembered over successive decades. And as you start the book, it begins, you know, with the moment of his death. If from that very moment, people are beginning to argue, what does Theodore Roosevelt mean and what is his legacy going to be? And for many people, it's like there's a cafeteria of things to choose from in terms of trying to figure that out for themselves.
I think that's a good way of describing it. It's a smorgasbord of legacy themes. When Roosevelt dies in 1919, it comes out of nowhere. I mean, he had been sick for a number of months and been hospitalized, in fact, but no one expected him to disappear off the political scene, you know, off the face of the earth. And when he does die, there's this outpouring of tribute, people that had fought with him during, you know, during his time as president, or indeed before and after that, had come out to revere, you know, at least his stamina, if not his politics. But the interesting thing that happens in those moments after he dies is that sort of trying to capture the essence of this man is impossible. It's like a bar of soap slipping out of your hands. Every time you think you have it, it's gone. And one of my favorite stories was James Earl Fraser, the famous sculptor, cast a death mask of Theodore Roosevelt moments after he died. And, you know, this is literally cast from his face. And when people saw it, they looked at it and they just dismissed it as nothing like the man that they knew. That somehow even the death mask couldn't capture him. And so at his funeral, which was a quite austere, conservative event, there was no singing, there was no eulogy, and he's buried in a plot of land in, you know, in Long Island, which is, you know, not on the beaten path. People at that funeral started to say, well, maybe we should memorialize him in some other way, because although we know him and we know how important he was, future generations, based on the funeral, based on the gravesite, would have no idea that this is a man who had such a considerable influence on the American experience.
One of the things that really comes out in those first years is just how large he loomed contemporaries. And you mentioned the famous sculpture on Mount Rushmore. And I find that really captures the sense as to how people in the 1920s saw him, that he was that giant that ranked up there. And it was so much of it was a question of how do you properly, you know, commemorate or remember or memorialize this person who seemed to be the first truly, greater, you know, inarguably great president since Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point you make about the 1920s being this period of great importance. I think that what I found from the research was that those first years in terms of memorial activity are vital. They define the next 100 years. In fact, the first couple of months almost define it. There's a meeting of the memorializers are going to there's a group of female memorializers called the Women's Memorial Association, and there's a group of men. For a number of reasons, they wound up segregating themselves. There were real differences about how they wanted to memorialize Roosevelt. But collectively, I make the case that there was five themes that they came up with. And they don't sound kind of the same as they would in the 21st century as they did at the beginning of the 20th. So the first one that they all believed in was this idea of Americanism, which isn't really a term that we use, but it came to embody ideas of patriotism, the civic virtues of the American system, democracy, and all that sort of things. But also some kind of, you know, not so nice aspects either. It was a anti-communist movement. It was a kind of anti-immigrant movement as well. And so what I make this case in the book is that all of these memorial themes have two sides to them. And they're also interrelated. So I mentioned there was five. Americanism is only one of them. And it's got that latent dualism in it. The second one is really around this cowboy image. Roosevelt is a cowboy. And in the one instance, there's the virtuous cowboy, the one who's, you know, crusading to make the world a better place and, you know, kind of lives up to a lot of those American ideals of the cowboy myth. And on the flip side of that, there's sort of the hasty cowboy, the one who's living on the edge of barbarism and civilization. I think that's best embodied by what Marcus Hanna said about Roosevelt. He called him that damned cowboy. So there's those two. And obviously the cowboy is wrapped up with the American experience. So that fits in with the previous theme. The third theme is the progressive. Roosevelt certainly was a progressive. Even if he hadn't ran as a progressive in 1912, he had a long history of progressive reform, political progressive reform. But again, there's the flip side, you know, the one that's progressing society to a better place. The flip side, the sort of radical progressive, which some people viewed him as. That ties in really with his ideas about conservation, the fourth theme. The conservation theme also has a latent dualism between, you know, preserving land for future generation, future generations. But even in the debates that we have today about resource usage, there's this question about, are we serving the best the business interests and economic interests? So there's a balance there between those two sides. And finally, the last theme that I made a case for was this preacher of righteousness, because what, as I was doing the research, what I found out is that Roosevelt was actually an incredibly religious person. And I think that that also couples nicely with how we have to see him, which is as a great publicist. He, you know, the bully pulpit, this idea of the presidency being this staging ground for shifting public opinion, that very terminology began with Theodore Roosevelt. So, you know, whether it's his the 50 books that he wound up publishing, or the hundreds of thousands of letters that he sent to people around the United States and around the world, Roosevelt was a publicist and a deeply religious one at that. So all in all, the book makes this case that there are these five themes, and they completely come out of the first 10 years of memorial practices and activities. And it is from different constituencies that they develop. So, for example, Theodore Roosevelt's good friend and the first head of the U.S. Forestry Service, Gifford Pinchot, later governor of Pennsylvania, he says at one of these meetings that we can memorialize him in a number of ways, but for Pinchot, it was Roosevelt the conservationist. That is the thing that spoke to him. And say, for example, Herman Hagedorn, who was one of the directors of the Roosevelt Memorial Association and a poet and a writer and an advocate of Americanism, Herman Hagedorn really wanted to focus on Roosevelt's patriotism. And he does that throughout his time as director. Hagedorn will serve as director from the 1920s all the way into the 1950s. So these early 20s are fundamental, and the memorials that develop, be it things like Mount Rushmore, which starts becoming a reality in 1926, or whether it's other memorials, they really stem from the agents of memory, these people that were Roosevelt's contemporaries that had a vested interest in promoting the things that he could be affiliated with.
That phrase, vested interest, I think is especially important when you're talking about this period of Roosevelt's afterlife, because it's a time at which a lot of people are tied to him. And this gets to this very fascinating struggle that you describe between the Oyster Bay Roosevelts and the Hyde Park Roosevelts that has this huge political saliency for Americans in the 1920s, 1930s, especially, and well into the 1940s.
Yeah, so this is a family that, I mean, everyone knows Franklin, Eleanor, and Theodore. And I can't tell you how many events that I've been to where we've talked about those three personalities, largely at the expense of the rest of the family. This is an incredible family that goes well beyond these three personalities. Even I met Ken Burns at an event in the U.S. Embassy in London, and I asked him about, because he has that 14-hour-long documentary, The Roosevelts. And I asked him, I said, you know, do you think there could have been more time for the other Roosevelts? And he was convinced that, you know, he probably could have spent another 14 hours on the other Roosevelts. But the really important character, I think, for the book and for really for Theodore Roosevelt's legacy is Ted, his son, because he has a really conflicted relationship with his cousin Franklin, who of course eventually becomes president. But Ted was, in the eyes of the Oyster Bay clan, which is the Long Island Roosevelts, of which Theodore Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt are members of, that group saw Ted as being the namesake, as the one who was going to lead in the footprints of his father, Theodore. Eleanor, when she marries Franklin, she sees in Franklin very much the personality that can – the charismatic personality that can lead in those footprints. And Franklin sees himself in that way too. So when Franklin runs for vice president in 1920, you know, only a year after his cousin Theodore is dead, people remember that name intimately, and they don't know this guy, this young guy, Franklin, who's running for vice president. You know, he was assistant secretary of the Navy before he got the nomination. And when he goes to travel around in the West particularly, his advance man, Stephen Early, tells Franklin, use the name. And what Franklin begins to do is adapt his language to sound more like Theodore. He says things like bully and delighted at rallies. And he looks kind of like him. He's got a pince-nez and he's, he throws his fists up in the air. He doesn't forcefully tell reporters that he's not a Roosevelt from that line of the family. And that begins to irritate the Oyster Bay clan, who – what happens after that is that Ted effectively follows Franklin around on his 1920 campaign, telling him – or telling the public that Franklin doesn't bear the hallmark of the Roosevelt family. He's not the same Roosevelt. But the reality is most people know that. I mean, the electorate isn't stupid. They know that this guy isn't Theodore. So that relationship between Ted and Franklin – really, the animosity between the two of them sparks interfamily war of words and a number of grievances that go on really until the 1980s. But the thing that really challenges that relationship comes in the 1920s when the Teapot Dome controversy scandal that breaks out during the Harding administration is going to taint Ted's character. Although after Teapot Dome, Ted will run for governor, he fails miserably to oust. He has no chance of beating Al Smith in that election, and he never runs for office after 1924. So the 20s see the decline of the Oyster Bay family, and really after, despite catching polio in 1920 and being out of politics for about 4 years, Franklin Roosevelt, by the end of that decade, is completely in the ascendancy. Him and his wife are transforming New York, and they are, by 1932, Franklin is the most likely choice for president at that stage. So this is something that goes on, though. When Franklin is president, Ted and Franklin don't see eye to eye on the New Deal. Ted sees it very much as the unnecessary growth of the welfare state. Alice Roosevelt, who is Theodore's oldest daughter, famously, when Franklin takes the currency off the gold standard, she famously appears at a gala draped in gold to try and, kind of make her own form of protest. In fact, she never gets over that animosity of the 1920 election. Ted, once the war starts, once World War II is in full swing, he sort of gets behind Franklin, and they put aside their differences. Ted famously makes his way to the beaches at Normandy and wins the Medal of Honor posthumously. But it's without question that Franklin is really the person that takes the Theodore Roosevelt legacy into the next generation. And although some historians have said that Franklin eclipses Theodore Roosevelt and, that he's forgotten, I think that's wrong. I actually think that because of Franklin, Theodore Roosevelt becomes more nuanced. He gains more sides almost, and now later generations are able to claim a sort of a heritage of the Roosevelt heritage that is followed through by Franklin.
And that's one of the things that makes that struggle so interesting, because it so much of it was an argument about what Theodore Roosevelt meant. Franklin Roosevelt very famously tied himself to Theodore Roosevelt, not just with the things you mentioned, but also with, for example, the very idea of the New Deal, which harkened back to Theodore Roosevelt's Square Deal. So Franklin's hitching himself to, as you described, to this this Rooseveltian, that aspect of Theodore Roosevelt's legacy, and yet you have the Oyster Bay Roosevelts who are fuming at what so many of them see as the unwanted hijacking of what their father meant.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I take it a step further. It's not only Franklin who's kind of co-opting Theodore, but it is a whole generation of people that see Theodore Roosevelt, the progressive. And I mean, really, in 1912, that election in 1912 transformed the political system in the United States so completely that I think we're you know, until 1968, it was the same political cycle. You had the Republican Party could have been in power probably for years to come, but Roosevelt represents this, Theodore Roosevelt represents this major break where you've got a progressive brand and a conservative brand within the Republican Party. Now, within that progressive band, which of course splits in 1912 and Roosevelt runs as the Bull Moose candidate, within that brand, there are people like Rex Tugwell, Adolph Baerle, the people that will become the brain trust effectively in Franklin Roosevelt's first administration. And it's those people, this is the interesting story, I think, in the book, is that the agents of Theodore Roosevelt's memory are very much the ones that that worked with him in those early campaigns for things like universal health care, women's suffrage, direct elections of senators, and they become implanted in Franklin Roosevelt's administration. Harold Ix, he's another really good example. And the list goes on and on.
And yet, at the very time that you're seeing this, what you describe as Franklin Roosevelt in effect maintaining and cementing so much of Theodore Roosevelt's image, there seems to be a tailing off of the memorialization. You describe, for example, the effort in the 1920s to restore the brownstone, to put a monument on the mall near the tidal pool, and so much of that seems to tail off. And with you have all these books being written, but then Henry Pringle comes out with his book in, I think it was 1931. And after that, you stop seeing major biographical studies of Theodore Roosevelt. So there does seem to be this ebbing of this initial burst of attempts to memorialize, remember Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah, it does. It swings in roundabouts, and ebb and flow is a really good way of putting it, because actually you do have these moments of mass memorialization where, often in a very monolithic way. So Theodore Roosevelt in the 1920s appears as a saint. You know, the biographies are hagiographies. The memorials that develop are almost one-dimensional. There's no complexity there, which, as we said from the beginning of this podcast, that this is a very complex character. So it's ironic that in the early iterations of his legacy, he's very one-sided. But take, for example, the brownstone that you mentioned on East 20th Street in Manhattan, which is where Roosevelt was born. But it's a replica building. The building that was there before they had rebuilt this memorial, was a commercial building. In fact, Theodore Roosevelt never wanted the home to be rebuilt there. There was when he was president, the original home was still there, and he sanctioned it being knocked down. He didn't want any memorial of that kind whatsoever. And what I found really interesting about in all the paperwork and all the paper trails, the Women's Memorial Association that built that wanted to build this site to teach immigrants how to become good Americans. This was very much a 1920s project to root out communism during the Red Scare, and to ensure that New York society was, the poor and the immigrant classes that were coming into New York, that they were becoming good citizens effectively. Now, what that does is it immediately dates the project. You know, the Red Scare is more or less over by 1921-22. Immigration begins to tail off by 1924 when you see the introduction of a quota system. So the purpose of that site, it almost loses meaning by the end of the 1920s. Now, interestingly, the Men's Roosevelt Association, they recognize that, and they basically set up a system by which there will be no political memorials. And they want to create a memorial in Washington, D.C. that is going to be artistic. It's going to be easily interpretable. Actually, like most of the memorials in D.C. are, you rarely find a memorial that doesn't have some sort of artistic, interpretive part of it. You know, think about the Washington's Monument or Lincoln's Temple or even Jefferson's Memorial, which originally was designed as a memorial to Theodore Roosevelt. So that site, the Tidal Basin, which is just south of Washington's Monument, that site was the last vacant spot in Pierre L'Enfant's plan for Washington, D.C., which your listeners will probably know that it was a shape of a cross, and it is today. You know, the National Mall runs in the shape of a cross. So this was the last spot, and in that way, it was a very sacred space for Washington, D.C. And the Roosevelt Memorial Association pursued a design competition and ran a design competition to come up with some plan for that site. And there was something like, you know, 12 or 13 architects or landscape artists that put into this design competition, and they had a winner, and the winner was John Russell Pope, who was at that stage the foremost Beaux-Arts style architect, you know, known for many different memorials around Washington, D.C. today. And what John Russell Pope had laid out was this huge, vast plaza with two 150-column semicircular colonnades, a centerpiece that was a 300-foot-tall geyser that that was decorated by naval sculptures, and it was huge. I mean, it would have dwarfed the Washington Monument. It would have dwarfed Lincoln's Temple. It was completely out of touch with the context of the time. I mean, Roosevelt at that stage had only been dead for a couple of years, and what they're proposing is the most audacious presidential memorial on the Mall. It would have put him next to Lincoln and Washington. It would have looked like the trio of greats at a time when people weren't yet sure. And I think really for me, what I thought torpedoed the efforts was the fact that Woodrow Wilson died in 1924. Just as these plans are starting to take off. So you've got Roosevelt's great rival passing away, and sort of people begin to go, well, you know, maybe he doesn't belong in this sacred space. And the Democrats in Congress start to push back against this the plans. And really by the end of the decade, there was, you know, this was not going to come off. And so, you know, you're right. And putting it in that framework, you've got at the end of the beginning of the 30s, you've got Henry Pringle's biography, which is a complete revision. And Roosevelt is now a juvenile, an adolescent who's too hasty and only out for himself, a raging ego. We see in 10 years a completely different person.
So you were describing this as taking place in waves. When does that second wave of memorialization appear?
Well, during the 1930s, I think you have some memorialization that's happening. I mean, Mount Rushmore is sort of, I mean, the plan was there, and that's coming to fruition. And then you've got Theodore Roosevelt Island actually gets bought in the 1930s, which is where his memorial is today, just west of the Lincoln Memorial in the Potomac. So there's things happening. In fact, the American Museum of Natural History, which is so controversial last year because it was red paint splashed across Theodore Roosevelt statue in front of that came online. I think that was finished by 1936. So there's stuff happening, but I think the thing about the 1930s and really the 1940s is that the image of Theodore Roosevelt is in decline because of biographers, because of theater productions. Things like Arsenic and Old Lace come out in theater, and then later on in the 40s as a film, a Frank Capra film. And Roosevelt appears like the Pringle portrait. He's very boisterous, loud, and juvenile. It's not really until the 1950s, after the publication of Theodore Roosevelt's Letters, which is an 8-volume, 20,000 letters published by Harvard University Press, historians start getting a new look at Roosevelt, and it's from that point on in the 1950s that cultural productions start to reflect this more nuanced image of Roosevelt. Some of the stuff from the 1920s mixed with some of the stuff from the 1930s and 40s. And as a result, you see, I think that the context is important here as well. Nationalism is in full swing again. The Cold War is causing Americans to think about Americanism again. And so a figure like Theodore Roosevelt is suddenly a lot more attractive. And so there's a new wave in the 1950s to memorialize Roosevelt in D.C., and there's new plans that emerge as well.
Wave of scholarship that really endures. You mentioned Howard Beale's book. There's John Morton Blum's The Republican Roosevelt. And with the letters, as you describe, it really does open up this wave of of scholarly attention as to his legacy. And as you described, the associations are beginning to evolve as well, as they're beginning to undergo leadership changes, and they're beginning to consider their role in terms of perpetuating Roosevelt's legacy beyond just the memorials that they've spent the past generation trying to erect.
Yeah, I have to say, if we're looking at the historians, my favorite is Richard Hofstadter. And I love Hofstadter's work for so many reasons. I mean, I wish I could write like him. He's got an incredible mind for writing and for picking out, what's important at a certain time. And what's great about his first book, which is the political tradition book, the American Political Tradition, he writes in 1948. I mean, this is his great work in many ways. But when he publishes that, Roosevelt in that is the Pringle Roosevelt. He's tempestuous. He's angry and loud. And actually, I think in that book, Hofstadter even calls him a Mussolini light. This is the guy who kind of, he's on the borderline of fascism and democracy. But interestingly, that view changes because, of course, in 1954, all of the letters are published. The first round of those letters that I mentioned are published in 1951, but the last book is published in 1954. And Hofstadter's impression changes remarkably. So his book that comes out in 51, 52, The Age of Reform. In this, Roosevelt gets a slightly revised look. He's not as egotistical. He may have had some good ideas in terms of progressive reform. Well, by the time Anti-Intellectualism, one of Hofstadter's books in the 60s, comes out, Roosevelt's actually he comes out pretty well in that. And, he was an important leader for the progressive movement and for intellectualism in general in America. And all of this is down to Hofstadter's view of Roosevelt through the letters. He actually didn't, because Hofstadter was an intellect who read voraciously, but actually didn't do the archival work that someone like Henry Pringle did on someone like Roosevelt. So being able to refer to these letters meant that people could read Roosevelt from his own notes, from his own voice, and what we see is a very nuanced person. We get the John Morton Bloom Republican Roosevelt. We get the diplomat and statesman that Howard K. Beale gave us, and then George Mowry as well, and others gave us this very progressive Roosevelt in the tradition of a Wilson and an FDR. So it's an important moment. It doesn't last very long, however, because that consensus history that came out in the 1950s, didn't last. And really, by the time the Vietnam War is kicking off, there's another decline in Roosevelt's reputation, and it's largely because the anti-war movement and the Vietnam War is proving that American intervention is as complicated, risky, bloody, murderous as it was during Roosevelt's time. And you can harken back to the Spanish-American War and the atrocities in the Philippines, and they map on very closely to those same atrocities and the wars, the war in Vietnam. So things like the Morro Massacre, in which Leonard Wood massacres women and children in Mindanao in the Philippines, maps very closely onto, say, the My Lai Massacre in Vietnam. And what you have is people rethinking America, America's place in the world in the late 1960s, and the reference point for that is very much Theodore Roosevelt. In fact, my PhD project on the anti-imperialists, people only went back and started looking at anti-imperialism in the 1960s when the Vietnam War was really sort of troubling people. So I think that's the second decline. But interestingly, that decline doesn't last very long either. So it really, by the 1980s, the Reagan Revolution and the resurgence in American patriotism brings Theodore Roosevelt back to the fore. Although Reagan doesn't quote Roosevelt very much, because of course Reagan can't really get his head around Roosevelt's progressivism, he does do things like support Caspar Weinberger. He's the defense secretary. His plans to name an aircraft carrier after Theodore Roosevelt, which is obviously a great expression of American power in the world, and something I'm sure Theodore Roosevelt would have enjoyed. But by that time, the 1980s comes around, Roosevelt, his image is changing with the times. It's not really until the 1990s that he becomes a truly bipartisan figure. I think for me, it's so much time has elapsed and he's so nuanced. By the 1990s, you have documentaries where Bill Clinton and Karl Rove are talking about how much they admire Theodore Roosevelt. You've got Dick Gephardt saying in his run for president how he wants to be a Theodore Roosevelt progressive. And you've got George W. Bush putting a painting of Theodore Roosevelt behind him in the Oval Office. So he becomes something for everybody at that stage.
We've been describing these surges and recessions in terms of Roosevelt's standing. And yet there's an aspect that you also address in your book in which he never really does seem to fade, and that's in popular culture. And yeah, I was point out how the second revival that takes place in the 1950s comes at a time when you start to see television becoming more important, and he starts appearing as characters in various Westerns, and you start to see that projecting this image of him to a whole generation for whom Theodore Roosevelt is as alive as, say, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. This is the generation who knows him only as a historical figure, and yet they're getting it not just in terms of these books, but in terms of his image on coffee cans, his image on television, and so forth.
Yeah, I'd say that was the most enjoyable part of the research, was being able to watch movies and television for hours on end, and it was research. It was fantastic. But the Westerns are the most telling. And I understand why people have written so extensively about Westerns. The metaphors in them and the turns in the narrative, they're so closely related to the American experience. And actually, Westerns are so pervasive in that post-war period. In the 50s and 60s, I think there's a statistic in the book that comes from Richard Slotkin's work on the West and on Western presentations. Nearly a third of all outputs from studios were Westerns, in like a 15-year period. It's sustained. You know, the Western was the way that people were digesting this new world. You know, John Ford's movies were as much about Apaches as they were about communists. The stories mapped so closely together. And Roosevelt has a slightly different appearance in television as he does in the cinema, but in movies he was often the statesman who also had this backstory as a rough rider. So the example I like to give about the movie that best exemplifies this is a movie called In Old Oklahoma, where John Wayne. He stumbles upon this town that's in real trouble. It's got this plutocratic oil baron who's trying to take possession of all the land. And as the good guy, John Wayne comes in and says, "Well, actually, you know, we could do this collectively." And there's a big standoff that ends in the White House, where you've got the oil baron and John Wayne knocking on the door of Theodore Roosevelt to settle the dispute. And wouldn't it happen, but Theodore Roosevelt knows John Wayne. His name is Daniel Summers in the movie. But anyway, he knows Daniel Summers from back in the days in the Rough Riders. And he says to Daniel Summers, he says, "You know, I trust you. You were the best Rough Rider. And if you think you can pull this off, then you've got it. But you've got this amount of time. And if you don't pull it off, the oil and the land goes to this oil baron." Well, of course, you know, he pulls it off last minute. You know, the oil baron and his trickery didn't win the day. But it's very much a story about, you know, fairness, progressive politics, but also this reference to the American spirit and the can-do attitude. And that comes out in almost all of the films during the 1950s and even the early 1960s.
You even see it in the 1970s with the most, you know, famous depiction of that decade, which was The Wind and the Lion, which is, as you point out, it is a very different Roosevelt, and yet still exemplifies that notion of can do, and with Theodore Roosevelt, you know, leading the charge in that process.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mark. The one difference I would say about the Westerns is that they're not tongue in cheek. The Wind and the Lion, which comes out in 1974. is it's kind of tongue in cheek. You kind of question this American can-do spirit a little bit. And let me explain why. That movie actually was released, coincidentally, the week of the Mayaguez incident in Cambodia, which was the sort of the final moment of the final moment of the Vietnam War, if you will, I think anyway. And this is where American soldiers are taken hostage by the Cambodians, and Gerald Ford needs to decide, if he's going to intervene or not. It mapped on very closely to the film, which was about American intervention in Morocco. But the great thing about that is that there was no intervention in Morocco. The film is a complete farce. It's anachronistic. In fact, it's a story about Ion Perticaris, a Greek American who gets kidnapped by this Moroccan bandit called Mouly al-Razouli, who's got a royal heritage. In the film, the Moroccan bandit is Sean Connery, so Scottish accent versus what would be some sort of Moroccan accent, I guess. And then the Ion Perticaris, who's supposed to be a fat, bald Greek man, is Candace Bergen. A blonde, beautiful hair, and yeah, I mean, it couldn't be any more different. So, in any case, I think the role that Brian Keith plays in the film as Roosevelt is very much tongue in cheek, in which he makes a couple of soliloquies in the film about American power, and he compares the United States to a bear who's blind and reckless, but ultimately, has good intentions. Whereas the films in the 1950s, they don't have that nuance. They're very much America's role in the world is only a positive one, and it's saving the world from communism and bringing democracy to benighted peoples.
How has Theodore Roosevelt endured as an American icon then? I mean, is it because he is so nuanced, because we can always find Theodore Roosevelt for the times? Or is it just because he was such a larger-than-life personality that he just stands out compared to so many other figures who occupy the presidency who are much more limited, controlled, not quite as bombastic or flamboyant?
Well, I mean, he's certainly a huge personality. You couldn't ignore him. I mean, I know that his daughter who famously said he wants to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, and the baby at every christening. I mean, I think that probably was the case. And that's led to him publicizing himself. I said he's a great publicist. But you mentioned ebb and flow. I think it is that sort of that rhythm of change that his legacy has undergone. So, he wasn't right as this perfect saint. He also wasn't right as this juvenile delinquent. Somewhere in between, we tinkered with that from, say, the 1950s to the 1990s. That seems probably closer, but he's such a complex character that you can never really get a handle on him. And I think in some cases, people have completely given up trying to find a truth in Theodore Roosevelt. In fact, I make the case in the book that really, since probably the 2000s, the 21st century, he doesn't, those legacy themes are still there, but actually you can dispense with them entirely, and there's a Roosevelt meaning for everyone in an everlasting kind of way. So let me give you an example, I guess. In 2015, only a couple of years ago, Cadillac ran this integrated campaign for its cars. So integrated in the sense that there was an internet ad, a television ad, a radio ad, and a print ad. And what they did is they just quoted a Theodore Roosevelt, a famous quote from his speech, the Man in the Arena speech, which was a 1910 speech that he gave at the Sorbonne in France. But, the famous line that a lot of people know is, it's not the critic who counts, it's the man who's actually in the arena, right? And that's something that, presidents have used. I mean, Miley Cyrus has a tattoo of it on her arm. But Cadillac, what they did is they just quote this. They just quote it as the car goes by on the TV, or over the sounds of streams on the radio, or in the internet campaigns. And you know the quote from somewhere, but you can't quite put your finger on it. And the tagline for Cadillac is "Dare greatly." Now that is, that's the line from this speech, this Man in the Arena speech. And that's the thing about Roosevelt. I think that people, they know that this is him. They have an idea that this is him. But now he's become almost so ubiquitous that we use these words that are related to him. I said bully pulpit earlier. We could say other words like speak softly and carry a big stick. I know he quoted that was an African proverb, but I've yet to find any African proverb that uses it. You know, this guy created a new political system. He started conversations that we still haven't finished having. And so I think because of that, he becomes very compelling. Everyone can draw something from his legacy, find something that relates to them.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, right. Well, I could sort of want to turn my hand back to the diplomatic history a bit more, and but also keep my hand in the sort of memory field, I guess, as well. What I'd like to work on next is these networks of power, and I suppose the research on Roosevelt, which really isn't about Roosevelt, it's about all these other actors, memorializers. And what I found with that was that often we're not telling their story. We're not telling the story of Herman Hagedorn or the people that are behind all these memorials. We're talking about the people themselves. But actually, I'm fascinated by the networks of power in diplomatic history, and not only what they accomplish, but also who they exclude. I think what you find in diplomatic history is often the story of a lot of white men. And I think, it's interesting what's not there, and, you know, the voices of women and minorities. And so I'd like to work on this project that kind of takes apart some of these networks of power.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting project. Mike, thanks for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Right. Thanks, Mark.